Hey, this is Cleveland Brown, and you're listening to the About Last Night podcast. I guess your TV must be broken. Haha, just kidding. Actually, I'm not kidding. You're bored.
Hey, Adam, what are you thankful for?
I'll tell you, Brad, and I appreciate you asking. My mom's cooking, clean balls, and having clean balls while I eat my mom's cooking. And you know who did that to me? Manscaped. Thank you to Manscaped for supporting the About Last Night podcast. If you don't know who they are, your balls must not be well kept. Manscaped is number one in men's below-the-belt grooming, wink, wink, the balls, with the right tools for the right job. And if you want to have clean, perfect balls, go right now to manscaped.com and put in the promo code ALN to get 20% off your order, free shipping, and a free travel bag. What's that promo code, Brad?
That promo code is ALN.
At manscaped.com for 20% off, free shipping, and a free travel bag.
And now, enjoy the episode.
This weekend, I will be at the Pittsburgh Improv in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Do you live in Pittsburgh? Do you live nearby? Come out and see me this Thursday through Saturday. Tickets at AdamRayComedy.com or Improv.com. Pittsburgh Improv, August 8th through the 10th. First time there. Cannot wait. And then next weekend, August 17th, I'll be in Monterey with Adam Carolla doing Adam Carolla is Unprepared. Tickets at AdamRayComedy.com. And then August 22nd through the 25th, I'm at Rooster Tea Feathers in Sunnyvale, California. Tickets at AdamRayComedy.com. This weekend, Brad Williams is going to be in Las Vegas, baby, at the Jimmy Kimmel Comedy Club, a new club in Vegas, August 8th through the 11th. Go see Brad. Jimmy Kimmel's Comedy Club. Tickets at bradwilliamscomedy.com. Today's episode is a beast of an episode. We're talking legend status. Been at the Comedy Store since 1976. Guest hosted The Tonight Show more than anyone in the history of The Tonight Show. Was a part, an integral part of the creation and founding of the Comedy Store on Sunset Boulevard. Just a legend in his own right. Articles syndicated all over the New York Times. Hosts a weekly show on Facebook and YouTube. The Argus Hamilton Show, which you got to check out. He's at every big Comic-Con, and it's a blast. Brad and I have done it, and he's here today making his ALN debut. The one and only Argus Hamilton makes his podcast Loft debut here in Los Angeles, and we talked everything. Comedy Store, the early days of Robin Williams, Jim Carrey, the transition that the Comedy Store has gone through, how the names on the wall got created, his relationship with Mitzi, Johnny Carson. We covered it all. This episode is truly one of my faves, and if you're a comedy junkie, you're going to love it. So follow Argus on Twitter and Instagram at Argus Hamilton, me at Adam Ray Comedy, Brad at Funny Brad on Twitter, at Brad Williams Comic on Instagram, at ALN Podcast on Instagram and Twitter, AdamRayComedy.com for all my tour dates, BradWilliamsComedy.com for his tour dates. Read the Room, my album is still out on iTunes and Spotify. Go get it, listen to it, love it, and then come to my shows and hear the new shit, baby. AboutLastNightPodcast.com for all your ALN merch and past and present eps. And ShopAdamRay.com for all the Adam Ray merch. She-Ra Season 3 has dropped on Netflix, so go check that out. DreamWorks is She-Ra. I voice Swiftwind, the talking horse. That's on Netflix, streaming now. And a lot more exciting stuff coming up. And some killer guests that we have confirmed. Holy shit. Chris Jericho, Gary Payton, Seattle Supersonic legend. Stamos is finally happening, so get excited for that. And stay subscribed on iTunes. Give us a 5-star rating and comment on the iTunes page. And email us at aboutlastnightpod@gmail.com. We've got some fun new announcements coming up that we will be using these emails for. So email us at aboutlastnightpod@gmail.com. Where you get the pod, what you love about it, your favorite eps, where you listen to it, and all that jazz. Now that we got the tour dates, Twitter handles, and merch info out of the way, sit back, relax, and enjoy a brand new episode of the About Last Night podcast with the one and only Argus Hamilton.
Well, the weekend's over and it's time to chat about it.
It's time to chat about it.
Got a midget and a juice, so why don't you sit down and listen to our dope podcast. Whether lunch, dinner, or breakfast. Brad Williams and Adam Ray are here for you any time of day. So
come over and treat yourself right. It's about last night. Come on and treat yourself right. It's about last night. Well, come on and treat yourself right. It's about last night. So come on and treat yourself right. It's about last night.
Bill Hicks used to call time to pull the ripcord and parachute safely to Dick Joke Island.
Oh, isn't that great? That's so appropriate and so good. Yeah, there's tricks you can do to get him back. Like, but if you're Stephen Wright and you go, I once spilled spot remover on my dog, I haven't found him in weeks. Like, if that doesn't hit, I mean, it's a great joke, but it, like, if that doesn't hit, what do you do? You just got to go, all right, and then go on to the next one.
Boston comics were furious that they felt he cut in line.
Yeah.
When he flew out to L.A. early and started doing the Tonight Show.
Yeah.
Because they felt like he was like third or fourth in line at that big club in Boston.
Oh, yeah. And like, what was it? The Ding Ho? Or no. Ding Ho? What was the...
But you know, Lenny Clark was the big MC.
Right. He's the guy.
The guy who did the Fireman Show.
Fireman Show. Oh, Leary.
Yeah. Dennis Leary.
Yeah.
All these guys were... And a couple of Irish comics were just... Kevin...
Oh, Mooney?
Mooney.
Yeah.
These guys were way ahead of him in the pecking order in Boston, and he just came out and took
storm. And that's the thing that always confuses me, and I've definitely fallen into this trap before, that people think there's an order. And it's like, no.
No, there's not.
There's no logical thing to this. There's no like, okay, it's time for Brad's sitcom. No one else gets a sitcom. Yeah. Brad gets a sitcom now. That doesn't happen. There is no order. That's just...
Back then it was, you impress Mitzi, okay?
Yep.
And then your next task is to impress Jim McCauley, and then your next deal is to impress Carson.
Because Jim McCauley booked Carson?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was the talent coordinator. And what you didn't know when you walked out and did the Tonight Show, especially the first time, was that you're used to playing clubs with the front row right up next to you.
Yeah.
You know, everybody's friendly. It's packed just like dynamite or a firecracker, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
For explosion. And... the NBC studios had been built in 1953 and 54 to try to lure Jack Benny, Red Skelton, and all Sid Caesar, all these great sketch comics from CBS over to NBC.
Sid Caesar, okay? show of shows.
And so what they did was they made these huge studios sketch comedy friendly. And you would have 400 seats, and you have the cameras in between the seats and you.
Wow.
And so you would have 40 feet between you and the front row.
Wow. And so three huge
RCA cameras.
Yeah.
And so it takes you one joke to figure out the studio audience is watching the camera, the monitors, just like they're sitting at home.
Yeah. They're watching you.
They're not. They're watching the monitors.
Up.
Okay. They're all watching the monitors.
Yeah.
So what you do is you got three cameras, one, two, three, and you go for the three setup joke, you go premise to that camera, setup to that camera, punchline to the middle camera. And they explode.
Wow. I've heard probably hundreds, if not thousands, of people talk about their experiences on The Tonight Show. I've never heard one person describe it that way.
Yeah. That's how it was. And you instinctively reacted and did the right thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because none of us, at least since in 76 and 77,
our
whole cadre of comics at Westwood, when we were traveling between Westwood and the Sunset Store, we would sometimes stop off at Beverly Hills discos and get up on stage and perform for $25, okay? And these discos were death traps because you had the curse of all our business, the dance floor between you and the front row.
Yeah.
And then you had thick carpets, jealous Persians, and their Anglo girlfriends.
Who thought you were funny.
And
then the boyfriends are like, that's not good.
And then behind them, they're the backgammon players telling you to hold it down. And you know you're bombing when you can hear the dice rolling.
That's a good sign.
Yeah.
But it's $25, boy.
It's $25.
That's a lid.
Yeah. Wow. I was having this conversation with another comedian the other day because we did two shows, and then we heard about an open mic that was going until like 1 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
So we went, oh, well, let's go do the open mic. And as we're walking there, we're like, we are sick fuckers. You know that? Like, we just did two sold out shows in Columbus, Ohio.
Yeah.
And it was great, packed audiences, 450 people. And now we're like, ooh, is there a bagel shop that's got like 15 people that we can go talk to? Let's go do that. Like, we're sick.
You're a true comic at that point, right?
Yeah.
I mean, how many.
I don't know if you've ever been a cocaine addict, but you just described it.
You know what? It's funny you say that.
Like you're looking for little white speckles on the floor at 6 in the morning. Do I find a little more or go to 7-Eleven now that the liquor's open?
Yeah. It's funny you said that. I started a rumor when I was in high school that all dwarves are addicted to cocaine.
Oh, really?
I did that because I found out that, like, I kind of discovered that dwarves don't have any real stereotypes. All our stereotypes are like, we live in a tree, we make cookies, we make chocolate, you know. So, sorry, Adam, that's not real.
Is there a Santa Claus?
Yeah.
Are my parents getting back together?
But, so.
Nothing's real.
I started a rumor that dwarves are addicted to cocaine. So when I ran for class president, and the only reason why I did is because you could do a sketch. I didn't want to run the school. I just wanted to do a sketch for the entire school. So I did a sketch where part of the sketch, I dove into a wagon with powdered sugar in it. And all the kids were like, oh my God, it's real. And all the teachers were like, I don't understand. Like, is this a new thing? That's the only reason why I did it.
That's amazing.
And that's the closest I've ever done to doing cocaine.
And all the good looking chicks that would go to the Persians later on were loaded with money.
Exactly.
You were just acting like you're a millionaire.
Oh, anyway, it was fun.
Wait, so was that Westwood Comedy Store? Is that where you started? That was 1976.
Well, what would happen is that there was a tremendous generation of baby boomers just hitting the Comedy Store in 76. We just graduated from college.
Gotcha.
We'd all gone through Watergate, you know, and a tremendous amount of baby boomers. There were 75 million of us. Were turned off. Those of us who wanted to stand up and perform in front of the public, you know, you had about three options. You know, the stand-up comedy, politics, or the ministry. Okay, those are the three things where you perform for.
Yeah,
a living,
and
right?
Yeah, and you're coming from Oklahoma, where the ministry is probably the top.
And I'm the son, grandson, and great-grandson of Anglican ministers. So, trust me,
it's in the blood.
I'm familiar with it.
Wait, what part of Oklahoma, real quick?
Huh? Well, my father would move about every 6 years to larger churches.
Okay.
And so I was born down in southeast Oklahoma. I do a joke. It's called Little Dixie. So my birthstone is crystal meth. the point is that those were the three options.
Yeah.
And that Nixon and all the things that disillusioned America out of politics. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the really talented ones went into stand-up comedy.
Yeah.
And so the lay of the land was, when Johnny Carson moved The Tonight Show to Los Angeles in May of 72, it was the same month, the same year, that Sammy Shore opened the Comedy Store on the Sunset Strip.
Wow.
What that meant was that all the comics who'd been working at the Improv in New York City, led by Robert Klein, David, all these guys, Steve Landsberg, Jay Leno, all these, Jimmy Walker, all these great comics, they had to come out to Los Angeles in order to do The Tonight Show.
Right.
Because The Tonight Show was it. You had to do it if you wanted a career. And so they all migrated out, and the Comedy Store Sunset was the immediate beneficiary of all this, I would say 30 to 40 great New York-trained young comics.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. They would all permeate the Mike Douglas, Merv Griffin, and the Dinah Shore afternoon shows. And the really good ones would go on. Freddie Prinze was their mascot.
Yeah,
sure. Would go on to The Tonight Show. That was the lay of the land. So here come all the baby boomers my age, and Mitzi establishes a club over in Westwood, between Wilshire and Santa Monica on Westwood Boulevard. And it happens to be a 235-seat room, brick walls, low ceiling, a perfect room.
Perfect.
It's just as good as La Jolla.
Comedy
Store La Jolla. And so what Mitzi does is she uses that, she thinks, as her AAA farm club, where she's going to, you make regular, and she sends you over to Westwood.
Right.
And suddenly Westwood becomes what Elaine Boozer called Argus's treehouse. Okay. And all of these great, great young comics, we were all in the same pledge class in 76. Michael Keaton, Robin Williams, Arsenio Hall, Marshall Warfield. God.
Anybody good?
Ollie Joe Prater, Alan Steven, all these legends, absolute legends.
Mm-hmm.
There must have been two dozen legends in that one pledge class.
Yeah.
And so we would perform at Westwood every night. And Mitzi would have MCs, I would MC. And so Tuesday through Thursday and Sunday, we'd rule the roost.
Mm-hmm.
Then Friday and Saturday, she'd send the adults over to pack the room.
Sure.
And the big room packer was Jimmy J.J. Walker.
No kidding.
from Good Time.
Yeah,
because that was on at the time.
It was on for 8 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. 8 years, and that's when everybody watched network television.
Right, because that's you had four channels.
So Jimmy and the Westwood crowd, Jimmy was responsible for really the success of the Comedy Store that led up to Mitzi purchasing the entire Sunset Strip building in 1976.
Wow.
It was thanks to Jimmy Walker.
Wow.
He's the one that provided all the revenue.
That's amazing.
And did he get a kick out of like knowing that he was, you know, contributing his
No, he got a kick out
presence.
Of every audience.
Yeah.
That was his deal. He's one of us. He really is one of
and
us.
And I've gotten to, you know, meet him a few times, and he seems just so friendly. It just seems like this is who he was then, yeah?
Exactly. And great to everybody.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, he was making so much money at the time that you had these older baby boomers that had either migrated over from the Improv or started early here in 73, 74, like David Letterman and Jay Leno.
Yeah.
Jimmy Walker would put them to work, giving them $100 a week salaries to write jokes for him. And they would meet at Jimmy Walker's condo twice a week. And you would have Leno, Letterman, 14-year-old Byron Allen.
Wow.
And then two legendary...
To be fair, Byron already owned three networks at that point. That 14 years old, he was killing it.
Yeah. This is what happens if you listen to your mother.
Yeah. No shit.
To this, she would drop him off at Westwood and wait outside.
I mean, no way.
She's the power behind
And he was helping throw. Write jokes, too? Is that what you're saying? He was there to help?
Oh, yeah. He was a natural gag writer. He really was.
Wow.
And he would also have two other soon-to-be great gag writers, Wayne Klein and Monty Adam, if there's anybody in the joke writing community watching, they're legends.
Yeah.
And so, and what Jimmy would do was, he would take they would all write these tremendous one-liners for him.
Yeah.
And he would put them on note cards.
Mm-hmm.
And on Sunday night, Jimmy would sit on the stage at the Comedy Store Westwood, right after Larry David would scream at the crowd, tell them they didn't get his jokes to the stupid Los Angeles people, and only New Yorkers are smart.
Which killed every time. Or
it'd be this embarrassed silence, and I'd walk up on stage.
What would you say?
Act like it never happened.
Yeah.
Killing.
But now that the guy you've all come to see, the star of Good Time, Jimmy Walker, and he would go, yay. And he would sit, this is only on Sunday night, he would sit on this bar stool, and he would read these jokes at Leno, Letterman, Wayne Klein, Byron Allen, Monty ate him. Boom, 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 boom. Just murder. And throw him over his shoulder. And that's the last time he would ever do him.
Get the fuck out of here.
The last time. He threw away 6 hours of material a year just sitting up there having a good time with the audience.
Okay. I would be, like, if I was a comic back then, I would, like, be behind him with a catcher's mitt.
Yeah.
Just, like, be like, come on. I got to get a good new seven.
That's a great idea because there's a curtain up there. If you reach out.
Oh, sweet Lord.
Why did he do that? He just, was that a...
He was generous. He loved having those guys around. They probably made him sharper and funnier just hanging with him. But he loved hanging with him. And those guys were great to hang with if you love writing jokes. They really were.
Well,
they're all natural gag writers.
And they're just technicians. Like, when you hear Leno describe how you write a joke, it's like, oh, you've broken this down on a micro level.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it's amazing.
But you're the same way, Argus. You know, like you, I mean, I put you right in that same boat as all those guys.
Well, Leno was really... like you said, he was the one you watched for that perfect construction.
Yeah, right.
Letterman's jokes depended on his quirky personality.
Mm-hmm.
But Leno would have perfect jokes like he would talk about all the sleaze going on Hollywood Boulevard, the Sunset Boulevard, whatever was going on that week.
Sure.
He'd take a deep breath and he'd say, I just say this, if God doesn't destroy Hollywood, he owes Sodom and Gomorrah an apology. Man, the roof would just come down. There's the perfect joke on Hollywood.
Yeah. And it's a perfect joke and here's how I always describe the perfect joke is, what word do you take out? What word do you add in? Nothing.
So you get
it's done.
It. Yeah.
Yeah, it's done.
Yeah.
And to back up what Adam already said, like, you're that guy where I mean, your joke column, you're writing daily material. Like,
Facebook posts, you don't waste words, I feel like. I don't know where you got that.
Just adding one out front that Jeffrey Epstein is now on suicide watch, which means he sleeps with one eye open.
Come on.
Oh my God.
Yeah, Hillary's not allowed to visit.
Yeah.
How often do you?
I just brought him some wine that Vladimir Putin gave me the recipe for.
It's like, do you have a process? Do you have a thing where you go like, okay,
read the news first?
Yeah, I have a bowl of kicks. I read the news and I write jokes. Like, what's your thing in the morning?
What you do is, you look at the news item and you and you're trained there's about five different ways you can attack any news item, and whatever you think is funny is what you ought to go with. Okay.
Trust your instincts.
You know, I learned something in my last monologue on Tuesday, and that is that if I don't believe in the let's say the politics behind a joke,
sure,
I shouldn't tell it, because somehow the crowd will feel I'm not my soul's not in it.
Because
I'm always best when I'm telling an Adam Ray joke. It's not something that people would be laughing at Adam Ray. It would be a joke that Adam would laugh at too,
right?
And laugh at too. I'd say you can take that one and put it in the first person. And we'd all be happy.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm still waiting for that moment to happen.
I'm gonna come early.
Okay, good.
But you're right, but there's that thing, and it's amazing, and it takes you a while to figure it out as a comedian, where like, and I feel like this happens to a lot of comics when they're younger, where they see whoever's hot at the time, and they go, oh, that's what I have to do. I have to be, like, when I was coming up, it was Dane Cook. There was, you would go to any open mic, any show, and there'd be 10 Dane Cooks on the lineup.
Would any of them get a laugh?
No, because that's not Dane, who they're doing. They are. Dane Cook. Yeah, exactly.
That's funny.
Yeah, like Dane. That's Dane stuff. It works for him.
Yeah.
So like, you have to find out what works for you. And like you say, if you don't believe it's funny, don't say it, because the audience will know.
But what I went one step further. If I don't believe in the thought behind the premise, if I'm just doing it because it's a clever joke, don't do it. You have to believe in the attitude behind the joke.
Yeah, if you're like, oh, I have this really good anti-gun joke, but you're a pro-gun guy, it's gonna come out.
Yeah,
they're gonna
if
know.
If I were to do an anti-cocaine joke, people would go,
this isn't you.
Come on, come on.
How many jokes?
Is there a chick here you're trying to impress? That's it.
Who are you lying to, Argus?
Have you? Is there a certain amount of, like, do you have a joke quota that you want to fill in a day, or do you really, like, when do you feel like you've had a good writing day?
I'm obliged by the newspapers I write to write 13 jokes a day.
Gotcha.
And they're,
when did that start?
They're all three sentence jokes. Okay.
You've been doing that for how long?
Started Daily Oklahoman in 1991.
Wow.
Because I was sort of groomed. Everybody in the 80s, when I was doing all the Tonight Show shots, they said, well, Argus is like Johnny's son. Okay. Mm-hmm. And to be honest with you, Johnny was communicating with my father and with Mitzi at the time.
No way.
You know, about my cocaine and alcohol addiction.
Right.
And they would eventually get together, force me to go to the Betty Ford Center and get well, or I had no place to go and no daddy to fall back on.
Wow.
So that made me untrustworthy with the people up at NBC.
Sure.
Mm. So I got bypassed for the chance to guest host for say Shanling. Letterman was already going to guest host, right?
Yeah.
But Shanling
and Leno
went flying by me, because I was deemed either out there partying or too young in my recovery to have that responsibility. So in 91, after trying everything to get on as the host of a Fox talk show, I came real close to that, but I decided, well, I'll just retreat and go the newspaper route, like Will Rogers did,
who's
a good friend of my grandfather's, and started doing the newspaper thing.
Yeah.
And that came along with the Persian Gulf War and all this stuff, and suddenly I was hot again with the reporters, because the reporters, print reporters, were always really good to me.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
And that and your column got to be syndicated, like,
yeah,
everywhere.
The big deal that millennials wouldn't understand right now is that there was a great radio host that was bigger than Rush Limbaugh at the time, who had a 5 minutes or 10 minute news commentary that was syndicated all over the country, named Paul Harvey.
Mm. Okay.
And Paul Harvey was on the radio for 40 years. He was like Jesus on the radio. And he lived until like the age 97 or something. But he was a factor on radio up until about the year 2000. And for 8 years, Harvey would quote one of my jokes every day.
My
assistant would fax him the 13 jokes.
Yeah.
And so everybody knew me.
Yeah.
But I was on TV hiatus, because the young TV executives my age in the 90s thought I had already passed my sell-by date as far as getting becoming a host. After my first Tonight Show shot in 80, it was so huge, that and the next five coming through in the next year and a half, I was offered 36 sitcoms, and turned them all down.
I read that somewhere, and I was like, there's no way true.
I was not going to be known. It was because I was partying with Robin Williams, and he was miserable at being known as Mork. Okay.
Yeah.
And Jimmy Walker hated being called JJ.
Yeah.
And so I said, I don't want to be known by my sitcom character name the rest of my life. I want to host a talk show and do stand up anyway.
Yeah.
I'll stick to the Comedy Store.
Wow.
Not knowing what a survival compass I had inside me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because 25 years later, all my peers, they've gone through their sitcoms, they've gone through their fortunes, the kids' private school tuition, taxes,
divorces,
accounting, divorce settlements, you know, all this stuff.
Yeah.
And they're spent cartridges, all
gotta,
right?
Got to do it again.
And they're showing up at the Comedy Store, and there's no room at the inn.
Yeah.
Wow.
Okay.
Cause, yeah, because of all the people that have now come up and taken their place. But and it's always amazing to me because you look at, like, the Comedy Store Instagram, and it's – almost every post of that of that lineup will have someone go, like, because it'll have you know, Sebastian, Joe Rogan, Ali Wong, Liza, just all these big stars, and then it'll have Argus, and some people will comment like, "Who's this Argus Hamilton guy?" And then other people comment like, "No, you have to go see."
Oh,
like,
that's nice.
They'll fight with them, be like, "No, you have to see Argus."
Well, the Comedy Store social media maven Emma Lee is right here, and she's responsible for getting so much of this going.
You're crushing it,
and she's a terrific young comic herself.
Oh yeah,
mm-hmm. from Canada, but she is the one that gets us out there, and then
it's instrumental.
Then you've seen it. You've seen the comments. They're like, "Who's this Argus guy going on before Rogan?" Yeah. Everyone's like, "No, fucking show up early.
Yeah, yeah.
See Argus." And
this is why Rogan's here.
But that's your spot.
But guys at yours and Adam's level and all the way up to Rogan, you younger Gen Xers, okay, have really, really, this is your time. I mean, you guys, and this is a time you're going to be filling theaters and I just advise all of you, do not leave the Comedy Store.
I was going to say, what do you, I mean, obviously the Comedy Store has gone through and evolved in these, like, chapters of its existence, but, like, in it's so incredible that you've gotten to be a part of it from all stages. Uh-huh. And I mean, to me, there's no better time than now, but that only is to say after the time when you were there and it truly was in its origins. I feel like that
compare
to that.
Crazy.
And you can argue that the talent now in its own right is comparable to the talent that started, but it's like, to me, it's like none of it exists without that original group and that time and what was happening. And how much of that do you think about when you even just walk through the halls of the store now?
What I think about when I walk through is it has a lot to do with the transitioning you're talking about, because it was so much more organized before the TV show Make Me Laugh started in 1978. This is so important for comedy fans to know. You can Google this stuff, but there was a very strict hierarchy in stand-up comedy. You impress Mitzi or Bud Friedman over at the Improv.
Yep.
Mostly Mitzi, though. Then Jim McCauley, the Tonight Show guy, greenlights you. Then Carson. And what you have to remember is the entire industry, every night, or at least Tuesday, Wednesdays, and Thursdays, watch Johnny.
Yeah.
Okay? Every agent, manager, studio executive, watch Johnny.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're a brand new comic, and it's like a virgin coming out, getting off the bus in L.A. Let's get her.
Fresh meat.
And you go out on that stage and you kill that Tonight Show crowd, the whole town descends on you.
Yeah.
That morning, I wore a white suit on my first Tonight Show shot and just brought down the house. And Johnny didn't just invite me over. He walked over and shook my hand and stood there with me. And the crowd went nuts.
Because that was a big deal if he came over to you or you went to him.
Yeah. And so that night, all my buddies at the Comedy Store, my peers like Mike Binder, Alan Steven, Robin, Mitchell Walters, Biff Maynard, Tim Thomerson, we all went over to Mitzi's house to celebrate.
Okay? Yeah.
And celebrate we did.
Yeah.
And by 6:30 in the morning.
How'd you celebrate?
7:30 in the morning. We're out of blow. He's out of liquor. That means it's time to go home.
Yeah. It's 7:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
And this is like before cell phones. So when people are getting a hold of you, it's...
No getting a hold of you.
Yeah.
So Mitzi's up on North Doheny, you know, a steep three blocks above Sunset, above Gil Turner's liquor store. And she's worn out. So I said, I'll just walk home, you know, to West Hollywood. I'm halfway down the hill from Tower Records on Palm, above Santa Monica, below Sunset. And so I walk down Doheny, and when I get to Sunset, I turn left, and it's about 8 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And with God as my witness, as I'm walking down Sunset in this white suit, people are honking their horns, like, Argus, you were great. You killed it last night.
Holy shit.
I felt like a Roman general coming into Rome on a chariot, you know, with nobody telling me you're mortal. You know, you know what I mean?
Right.
And it was the most incredible experience, one of the most incredible experiences of my life, everybody honking. And I never forgot that everybody watched Johnny, because these were all agents and managers coming to work on the strip
at
the building. And And so that was the hierarchy then.
Yeah.
Then Make Me Laugh is there. And what Make Me Laugh does is it destroys, it's syndicated on Metro Media. So it's on against the local ABC, NBC, CBS newscasts, mm-hmm. right? In every market.
Okay.
And it kicks everybody's ass.
Yeah, because it's news or laughing.
Yes. I'm standing up, and you're the contestant, okay?
Yeah.
And there's a great studio audience here.
Yeah.
And I'm standing here, and I'm telling you jokes, trying to make you laugh,
mm-hmm.
secretly hoping you don't,
right?
Because the crowd's going nuts, and the camera's on me.
Right.
And so this goes on for 30 minutes a night, and it becomes hugely successful. What happens? Every city in America decides it can have a comedy club.
Oh, shit.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And all of a sudden, the comedy clubs mushroom, the number of comedians mushrooms.
Sure.
Another unintended effect is that it starts offering us comedians $5,000 to $10,000 a week, door money, in 1980, 79, 80, 81.
That's like $40,000, $50,000 a week.
When rent was $200 a month, the phone bill was $10 a month, and... gas was 60 cents a gallon.
Yeah, you're rich.
Yeah, so, exactly.
Yeah, you've got $18,000.
You can hire people to drive down the street and honk at you and scream, Harvest, you were great last night.
And that was just the hookers.
So. Yeah.
They were everywhere.
Yeah.
Because West Hollywood incorporated in 83, and there went the hookers.
Son of a bitch.
Yeah.
There went the hookers. I think I saw that on Broadway.
Yeah.
Come on, there's an AIDS epidemic.
Yeah.
Come on, don't give me, it's all a bad name. All right, and so. That was a trap.
Okay. Right.
First of all, it produced all these comedians, mm-hmm. but it lured a lot of LA headliners onto the road.
Yep.
Where they met the waitress, got married.
Oh man.
Started having kids.
And that was that.
And the town forgot about them.
The law of unintended consequences.
The town forgot about them because they were making so much money on the road.
Yeah.
And then, two, 3 years later, what happens? Well, a second comedy club pops up, and a third in each market.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty soon, they're in paper wars.
Yep.
And the amount of income goes down. These guys are stranded out there on the road.
Because now they're getting free tickets.
The baby boomers in the late 80s stopped. They finally settle down by 1990. They stop going out. They go to their homes and their churches and their real lives, leaving clubs to the mercy of this little Gen X generation you have that was only 35 million people.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a 10-year depression in the club business because all you guys did was go to Viper rooms and die in the parking lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, we were such buzzkills.
Those were the days.
Yeah. Oh, my God. But yeah, it's so amazing that you can track it like that. Like scientific, like you just go like, and that's where that happened, that's where that happened.
But at this time in the 90s, Mitzi's hanging tough. She's hanging tough, and she's taking mortgage after mortgage on her house up on North Doheny to keep the comedy store going.
No way.
Yeah. Then the catastrophe hits her, and... Her physical condition starts deteriorating when she finds out she has Parkinson's, and the Parkinson's takes a few years to devolve into Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
And you know, it gets pretty bad there for a while. But luckily, around 2004, 2005, the millennials turn 21. And they start streaming in.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like blood returns to the body. And then in 2013, young Brenton Biddlecombe comes to the comedy store, who knows how to use social media.
Yeah.
And
that's a good Brenton impression.
Yeah. And we have young comedians like like Sarah Mostajabi is willing to go down the line mm-hmm. on Saturday nights and get every customer's email address.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And email lists.
And suddenly we start compiling this list and we start putting together websites. And before we know it, these millennials, they're just too spoiled to stand in line wondering if they're going to get in the show. Mm-hmm. So they start buying up all the tickets before the show even starts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now we're sold out thanks to that. Thanks to millennials.
How much do you remember those conversations with Mitzi? I'm so curious about like that time when, I mean, you kind of brushed over, but it's like to have her take her mortgage from, like, to the extent that I don't think people realized that she was going through to keep the store alive and what she was going through. Like, and you were very mm-hmm. close with her. So like, you know, what do you remember moments where she was like, I might have to sell, or I might, or just having this, maybe an understanding at some point of like, I guess, man, like get in your last few sets. Cause things, I don't know if we can keep.
Think of her ex-husband, Sammy, mm-hmm. going on stage with Paulie until like weeks before he died at the age of 92, 93.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. All right. To Mitzi, the Comedy Store, because she was an art major at the University of Wisconsin when she met Sammy at the Wisconsin Dells in 52. And she was always an artist at heart. And to her, that lineup was her work of art every night. That was her gift to the public.
Yeah.
And she very carefully scheduled everybody in order of just the way she wanted that show to shape and bend.
She had ways, she had ebbs and flows, she had this is you know, this comic going here is going to help this comic, and then this one's dry so the show goes down, mm-hmm. so we put this comic, it was
like Jay would follow Robin, is that correct? I can't remember, somebody spoke to having to follow Robin, and or prior maybe Leno had to
See Robin from an early time on, from 1978-79, Robin was a drop-in. So whoever followed Robin just had to follow him.
Wow.
He was a drop-in. Because you couldn't schedule him, or it would be unfair to the either. I never understood why he wouldn't allow himself to be scheduled, because it would have helped Mitzi. It really would.
Yeah.
Because Richard allowed himself to be scheduled.
Sure.
But the point is that I just wanted to add is that there were a lot of more musical comedy acts back in that era.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Because in that era, everybody knew the same songs, everybody knew the same commercials and the same parodies that were erupted like vile mushrooms, song parodies. And you just murdered the crowd with a simple step.
The joke writers.
While we hardworking monologists sat there and see.
Oh, yeah.
We hate, like, and it's so funny because we're all friends with guitar comics. Yeah. It's fine. It's a talent in itself, but there's a part of us that goes, you son of a bitch.
Yeah. You got music
somebody
to
else's
you.
Lyrics, somebody else's song.
Yeah. Yeah.
I get all the glory. Look at my big schlong.
And see, they got a laugh.
Yeah, I got a big laugh. I actually want to close with that now.
Exactly.
I hate that.
Yeah.
We always
do. Sorry about the big laugh it just got.
So she never, I mean, her
she
pride with the lineups.
She would sprinkle in the musical acts just so.
Okay.
You know, for the break you were talking about.
But you know, to speak to her, just the conviction that she had as far as like, there was no plan B for the store not working.
Yeah. No, none at
she
all.
Just was like, when it was in hard times, I mean, did you ever see a look in her eye that was just like, or was it just always like, all right, we just need to figure another way to keep this going?
The hard times are a bit exaggerated now because, you know, the Friday night and Saturday night, she just had a 9 o'clock show Friday and 9 o'clock main room, and those shows were full.
Mm-hmm.
They were full.
Sure.
And the hard times are perceived to be, it might be an off tourist night or something. There might be 20 or 30 people in the original room. And people remember that now as 5 or 6, you know. but she was struggling.
Yeah.
She was struggling. And her consciousness went just about up to 2007 and 8. Mm-hmm. And I talked her into cooperating with both William Needle Cedar, I'm Dying Up Here, and Richard Zoglin, who the Time Magazine writer who wrote the other book about the Comedy Store.
Yeah.
And she made it through those lengthy interviews for really good biographies of the Comedy Store, if anybody wants to enjoy them.
Oh, yeah.
But the one person I haven't mentioned that I'd feel like I screwed up if I didn't was Richard.
Okay. Yeah.
Richard Pryor, what people cannot fathom right now, I don't know if there's a star, just a period of a star, not just Comedy Star, on the level of Richard Pryor with the baby boom.
Yeah.
Every generation of comedy fans has its naughty uncle, okay? Richard Pryor was 10 to 12 to 14 years older than baby boomers, okay?
Yeah.
But he was our Pied Piper.
Yeah.
Okay? When he would fade, Rodney Dangerfield would take his place as our naughty uncle.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? I'm trying to be the naughty uncle to the millennial. Yeah. I'm pretty good at it.
Yeah, you're very good.
Yeah. Yeah. And because I tell him just how to have enough fun, all the fun you can have just before rehab.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? But anyway, but I noticed that. And Richard, he had some film success, signed a $40 million deal with Columbia for like five movies.
Yeah.
And just before his accident in 1980. And you can't imagine the excitement on the Sunset Strip when he would decide to put together his next album. What would happen is Mitzi would have a regular show from 8 o'clock to 10.
Yeah.
Then empty the room.
Yeah.
And there would be a line outside. This is the original room.
Okay.
Coming into the original room, and Johnny Witherspoon,
yep,
Letterman's good buddy,
mm-hmm,
godfather to his son, was the head doorman along with Harris Pete, and they would make hundreds of dollars a night with the best seats, seating people for Richard. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And Richard, the thing for comedians to understand is that Richard would stand up there, refuse to do any old material,
yeah,
and would just build every single night while somebody was tape recording him, and he would just, like a jokesmith, wordsmith, and he would turn each thought into a story, and he reminded me of so much of Samuel Clemens. I tried to get him to name his last album Dark Twain. Okay.
You know, Samuel Clemens is Mark Twain's real name, for those who don't know.
Yeah, and then one night, I'm up at Mitzi's, and we got a call that Richard was at the hospital in Reseda,
mm-hmm,
and we motored over there real fast, and Jim Brown beat us there, and it was the three of us.
Well, he's the football player. He's the greatest running back of all time. I would hope he would beat you there.
Yeah. And giving Richard the worst possible advice, you know. What you gonna do? What you gonna do? What do you mean, what you gonna do? You're gonna go to Betty Ford and get
Yeah.
But it would be a while before Richard decided to go to treatment, and by then, mm-hmm, he was starting to have physical problems himself.
Yeah.
Damn, man.
But no one commanded and just absolutely had superstar status.
Well,
I was going to say, because we've got some crushers now, but you still, just nobody. It was a different time, but I mean, you just...
It was the way you looked at him. Because he was denied the lead role in Blazing Saddles because he was considered unreliable because same reason I was.
Right.
But this is 1973-74 unreliable.
Sure. Okay? Sure.
So Mel Brooks put him to work on the writing staff to put it together, and he was one of the writers, and they would keep a shoebox full of cocaine on the big conference table and just write these jokes all day that you still laugh at.
Wow.
Okay? But Pryor came out of that with his great breakout album, That Nigger's Crazy.
Yeah.
Okay?
By the way, that's the name of the album, people. So Argus is saying it, but it's the name of the album.
His mentor, Paul Mooney, were my mentors.
Yeah.
And, wow.
And they would deploy the N-word like a stiletto every night on us. They were just brilliant.
Perfect with it.
Perfect with it. And you can't say Richard without Paul Mooney.
Richard
had cracked up on stage in 1971 in Las Vegas,
mm-hmm,
doing cute little impressions, kind of like Jim Carrey it would happen to him 12 years later.
Yeah.
The cute little impressions that he just hated doing.
Yeah.
But they would kill every night, so he felt a need to do it. Yeah.
And so he cracked up in Vegas, came back to Hollywood. Paul Mooney got a hold of him,
mm-hmm,
and they thank goodness to Red Fox, they started writing scripts for Red Fox, mm-hmm, and Richard started getting his feet on, got up at the Comedy Store, and started being himself.
Yeah.
The same thing would happen to Jim Carrey 15 years later.
Yeah, I was going to say, same thing, huh?
Exact just, same thing.
When did that turn for him happen? Just he was doing impressions, and finally one day...
Jim Carrey was doing all these cute, really brilliant little impressions, one right after the other, but, you know, as boxed in as a Stephen Wright routine, just boxed in totally.
Yeah, he couldn't
that character.
He couldn't express himself. He couldn't do anything off script.
No, and he got tired of it. And one night he's up at Crest Hill, the house where I lived in, right above the Comedy Store that came with the purchase of the Comedy Store for Mitzi. Mm-hmm. So she turned it into a place where the comedians could live. And Andrew Dice Clay and Yakov Smirnoff and I lived up there, but the guys would all come up and party. And after I'd gotten sober, it was still used for that. And Sam Kinison was up with his crew and Jim Carrey partying one night. And it was Kinison, Kinison who turned Carrie around. He said, wow, you're hilarious. What the hell are you doing your cute little impressions for? Be yourself. Be this guy. Be this guy.
Because he was funny off stage, oh, huh?
He was brilliant.
Yeah.
Just brilliant. Yeah. And why do you want to be somebody else when you can strike it rich as you, you know? Mm-hmm. And so Jim went to Mitzi. We went to Mitzi, and Mitzi said, I agree with Sam. She said, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to put you up every night at 11:45, right next to Damon Wayans.
Jeez.
Get it? You see it coming?
Killer.
Yeah. All right. Killer. And after about 6 months, they become great friends. Jim's his breakout act, and Damon uses Jim as a designated white boy on Living Color.
Wow.
And the career is born.
Wow.
And that, holy and that's shit. That's the architect that Mitzi was.
Exactly.
Now, why does she want him to follow Damon?
Because Damon... She so respected Damon as an artist, and she could see Damon backing him up. No matter how much he struggled breaking out, she knew that Damon would get the crowd back.
Damon followed Jim.
Followed Jim.
Okay.
Yeah, and because Damon had a murderous act,
yeah,
but he loved experimenting and going deeper and deeper and deeper.
Yeah,
particularly with his leg thing.
Wow. Do you remember that turn when Jim did finally, I mean, after Living Color, did you kind of, were you sitting there like, you know, having a front row seat to it, being like, all right, well, I knew this was going to happen.
I saw him feeling his oats from it. And he went out on stage after Living Color, and the line still has to be linearly funny, right?
Mm-hmm.
But not if you're feeling your oats.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Jim Carrey walks out on stage, jam-packed house, huge round of applause,
sure,
and he says, yeah, you're great. You know, on the way here, I stopped by 7-Eleven, you know, homeless guy asked me for a dollar. I said, sorry, you know, I got nothing less than a 20. And I walked on, and the crowd went, and I told that to Mitzi. She said, that's hysterical. That's funny. That's funny.
Yeah. Hey, Brad, how you doing today?
Well, I'm doing fantastic, Adam.
Well, I want to tell you, I don't think as friends that we talk enough about how we keep our balls.
We really don't. And I think it's really unfortunate. And I think at this point in our relationship, we should be talking about how we keep our balls.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you what, back in the day, manscaping, it was horrible.
Dude, rough, literally.
You either used your own razor that you use on your face.
Or your stepdad's.
Maybe you stole your girlfriend's razor.
Gross.
And used them. And maybe
got to make up a lie to tell her you didn't use it on your balls.
Right. And you, all these things aren't designed for your balls, Adam. They nick, they cut, they hurt. It doesn't feel good.
Well, thankfully, Brad, Manscaped has the answer. What are they? Well, they're the number one men's below-the-belt grooming business. Manscaped offers precision-engineered tools for manscaping your balls with the right tool for the job. Now, a lot of people think that, using razors or the same trimmer used for your face is the way to go. And Manscaped is here to tell you that this is not the move, okay? There's so many times that we've nicked and knacked our ball sacks, like you mentioned, and it's just those days have got to be over. Manscaped, what they do, they offer amazing products like the Perfect Package 2.0 kit that features the Lawnmower 2.0 with skin-safe technology. What is the Lawnmower 2.0, Brad?
Oh, let me tell you about this thing, Adam. I have used this thing. It is wonderful. Imagine shaving your balls with no fear of the nicks and cuts. You get as close as you want. The Lawnmower 2.0, this trimmer won't nick or snag your nuts, and it's also 100% waterproof.
That's
so
great.
Guess what? Do it in the shower.
Because you don't want to get electrocuted trimming your balls in the shower. That's a terrible way to go.
Oh, here lies Brad Williams. How'd he die? Electrocution while shaving his nuts.
What were his last words?
Good. Ow, my balls.
Ow, my balls.
I don't want ow, my balls to be my last words.
Yeah.
And they won't be with all these great products. And Manscaped, if you get the Perfect Package 2.0 kit, you even get a shaving mat. So if you're not doing it in the shower, you lay it down. You don't get your towels dirty. You know those towels that you use to dry your face?
Yeah.
Now you're not getting a face full of pubes.
Yes.
Because you used a Manscaped mat. And let me tell you, the entire Perfect Package 2.0 kit also comes with ball deodorant and a ball spritzing spray.
What?
Maybe you're just going in and out. You don't have time to do the full thing. Get the spritz spray. You spritz it on. It's water. It's aloe. It's wonderful. It's like a vacation for your balls.
Because who said your balls don't want to be spritzed? Maybe Oprah, but look, she doesn't know what she's talking about. She may have good soups and good specials, but she doesn't know about balls. But Manscaped does. Get 20% off the Perfect Package 2.0 kit, free shipping, and a free travel bag with the code ALN at manscaped.com. Again, that's promo code ALN at manscaped.com to get 20% off the Perfect Package 2.0 kit, free shipping, and a free travel bag. Again, with that promo code ALN at manscaped.com. Get precision tools for your family jewels at manscaped.com using the promo code ALN. Brad, something in this room smells good, and it's not your face.
It's my balls, Adam. Yeah. I've got to know, because were you around when the strike happened?
I caused the strike.
You caused the strike.
You're talking to the right guy.
There we go. Now,
summer of 78.
Summer of 78. Now for those unfamiliar, or maybe you didn't like, or maybe you watched I'm Dying Up Here and thought, oh, that strike angle was pretty funny. No, that happened.
No, here's what happened.
Okay. Should we hug that mic a little bit more too? Just bring it up to you.
Okay. Mitzi purchased the entire Comedy Store in July of 76.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thanks to Richard, thanks to Jimmy Walker, she was able to get this balloon loan from God knows who, but she bought the famous Ciro's nightclub building with all three showrooms in it. All the time up till now, she had just simply leased the original room from the leasor, who was a great L.A. disc jockey from the Ricky Nelson late 50s era named Art LeBeau.
Okay.
Art LeBeau had the main room.
Gotcha.
Okay.
But Art still leased it from the owner. Mitzi bought the building out from under Art LeBeau, from the owner, mm-hmm. and tried to have LeBeau evicted. LeBeau still had his lease. He had Mitzi evicted from the original room for 3 months until she bought him out for $50,000 cash.
Wow.
And for three long months in the fall of 76, the entire Comedy Store was at Westwood, and everybody just had 10-minute sets. Okay.
Yeah. Oh my God.
So when Mitzi gets the entire building back, what happens is she redecorates, she hires this crooked paint salesman at a paint store if he'll give her a big discount on the paint. She's going to redecorate the main room. Mm-hmm. She'll make him assistant manager of the Comedy Store.
Oh, jeez. That's a pretty good deal.
Yeah, and the crook goes along with it. I know exactly what's going on because I'm not only the doorman and MC at Westwood, I'm Mitzi's runner during the day.
Yeah.
So I'm having to go all around town picking up all this paint and paintbrushes and all this material in Mitzi's little 1975 Pinto, okay, mm-hmm. using Mitzi's driver's license and checks to buy this stuff.
Yeah.
And And the funny thing is all the vendors knew Mitzi, but she scratched out with her pencil the year she was born because it's none of their business. Driver's license. Okay. So we buy all this stuff, and she redecorated this 400-seat main room so that her peers would have a room to play in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. Mitzi, as Sammy Shore's wife in the 1950s and 60s, he was in a great pledge class of comics too.
Oh, yeah.
Don Rickles, Shecky Green, Buddy Hackett, that whole group of great comics.
Right.
And she wanted them to perform in the main room. Shelley Berman and, of course, Dick Gregory, all these mm-hmm. giants. Mm-hmm. None of their agents would allow them to play the main room. Mm-hmm. Why?
No money.
No, it would hurt their Vegas draw.
Oh,
they were all tied to these big, rich contracts to the Bally's and Caesars. And if people in L.A. could see you at the Comedy Store, why would they drive to Vegas and not gamble?
Shit. Okay? Right.
So they didn't dare go in. Yeah. And they didn't hit Mitzi till they all refused her. So
what was her game plan?
What happened? Well, she would try this and that. And Tiny Tim, who you don't even know, but it was
From the Tonight Show.
Yeah.
Okay.
Tried him. He drew six customers.
Okay. And he was huge on the Tonight
45
Show.
45 million viewers on the Tonight Show when he married Miss Vicky.
Yeah, the most. Yeah, one of the highest rated moments in television history was his wedding.
Yeah, his wedding on the Tonight Show. Well, by 76. Interest had waned.
Well, I mean, he didn't really have much for now.
But anyway, she was trying a little novelty thing. She was able to get Dick Gregory, though.
Okay.
And it was a great thing because he would not allow alcohol to be served so that all these black families could come up from South Central LA and bring their children to see the great Dick Gregory. And wow, that was an experience. But there weren't that many times you could do that.
Yeah.
So what she did was she's sitting up in the main room booth all alone with me and Biff Maynard. about 2:30 in the morning in the summer of 78. Mm-hmm. And she's crying because she can't do anything about the main room.
Yeah.
And I say, Mitzi, you've got, I'm running Westwood now. I'm the host over there. We're sending 150 people a night on Friday and Saturday over to the Improv because we're full.
Yeah.
Okay. Why don't you put your comics in this main room?
Mm-hmm.
Why not?
Yeah.
And she said, well, that would make this a professional nightclub. I said, well, you would make it for Rickles and everybody else. She said, no, but this is part of the graduated system of da-da-da-da-da, because she didn't pay. It was a showcase club that you used to showcase for the industry.
Right.
And back then, everybody showcased for the industry because you weren't getting paid at the Comedy Store. So you got on TV pronto just to survive. Okay. So that was Comedy Store was more of a college then.
Yeah.
An artist colony. Well, Mitzi, finally, after Biff Maynard browbeat her into trying it, and she said, Argus, what's the reason against it? I gave Mitzi's line of defense. The Comedy Store is an artist colony, and it's not for paid people. It's you're to grow here, not to be paid here. I don't want to be a nightclub. I said, Mitzi, times have changed. You know, it's a nightclub now.
Mm-hmm.
We got a whole generation of people pouring in, and you've got a room here that Letterman, Leno, Gallagher, Skip Stevenson, Elaine Boozler, Marshall Warfield, Paul Mooney can pack this place while we're all packing the other rooms. Trust me. And so she devises a plan of six shows for $25 and tries to sell ticket packages and stuff, and it doesn't quite work. And she schedules a show for free in there, and Tom Dreesen and gets together with the 25 comics and meets with Mitzi and say, look, let's figure out a way to get paid in here. Mm-hmm. And she balked at first, and they negotiated back and forth, but Tom made what I thought was a mistake at the time of bringing in 200 comedians to the meetings instead of just the 20-25 main room comedians that would have played the main room.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And Mitzi finally settled with the 25, and they were celebrating it at Cantor's Deli. We did it. We're gonna have a place. You can go from Westwood to Sunset to the main room, and you know a lot of us won't even have to do the road. We're gonna do so well with the main room.
Yeah.
And Marshall Warfield and Brad Sanders come up to Dreesen in the in Cantor's and said, "What about us? What about the rest of us?"
Mm-hmm.
And Tom said, what do you mean? He said, well, we were all at the meeting with you. Weren't you, how about us at Westwood? And in the original room. And I believe, as it says in the book, I believe at that time that Dreesen realized he'd recruited an army to do the work of a platoon. Accidentally.
Yeah.
Everybody just wanted in on it.
Right. Yeah. And then he thought, oh, this will be a sledgehammer of force, not realizing, oh, shit.
And then they'd completely underestimated Mitzi because they thought they could just bully her into it.
Yeah.
And she said, absolutely not. The Westwood and the original room's going to be for an artist colony, graduated system of development.
Mm-hmm.
So they called a strike. And for five of the longest weeks of my life, you know, my friends, 150 of them, picketed the Comedy Store. While about 10 of us walked through the picket line and played every night.
So you crossed the picket line?
Oh, yeah. I was out on the picket line talking customers into coming through.
Wow. Comics getting mad at you as you're doing it?
No, they realized I'm not from working class anyway. My allegiances weren't with union anyway.
Okay.
My dad told me, you remember, your family fought and died for the queen. You do the same.
Hey, there you go. And Mitzi was the queen, for sure.
That's the Hamilton line coming. I was the royalist out there.
Yeah.
Fighting the masses. So, but Dreesen and all the rest of them said, as the book says in I'm Dying Up Here, he says, Argus Hamilton was always a gentleman. And I was. I said, these guys are my friends, but we got a great show tonight. And a lot of people, you know, anti-union people would drive into the Comedy Store just to walk through the picket line and watch the show.
No way.
Wow.
And the show would consist of me and Alan Bursky, Lois Bromfield, Yakov Smirnoff, Mike Binder, Biff Maynard. I'm still a great show. David Tyree, my God.
Oh, yeah. David Tyree. Oh, and, my God, so funny.
Yeah, we'd kill the crowd and have a great time.
Yeah.
But 2 weeks into the strike, I had an idea, and I went next door to the Hyatt House and met with the head of the strike guy that would eventually be the co-owner of the Improv, Mark Lano. And we sat in the mezzanine at the Hyatt House, and we worked out a deal where the comics would get paid $25 a set in the original room, 15 at Westwood and get half the door in the main room.
Mm-hmm.
We agreed on that. I took it back. I said, Mitzi, this is the deal. And it's going to work. We finally got it, and it's only taken 2 weeks.
Yeah.
She said, all right, let's do it. And we'll just get through this one more night. And Alan Steven and her walked down into the he was another one. He was great.
Oh, yeah.
Alan would sat by the window with Mitzi as the strikers were going by. And all of a sudden, they broke into song. And they, what were they singing? And they were singing the Tonight Show theme. It so happened that David Letterman was guest hosting for the first night of his career at the Tonight Show that night.
Yeah.
And his truck was pulling in up the Hyatt ramp, and they were wondering which side he was going to take.
Yeah.
Because in 1974, Letterman was discouraged and was about to drive back to Indianapolis, and Mitzi talked him out of it.
Wow.
What did she say? Do you know?
You've got it. You've got it. Yeah. You have to stay here. You're the next Carson. Mm-hmm. Don't you give up. You know?
Can you imagine?
She said this in 74. So because of her, he stayed. All right.
You're welcome, everybody.
Because of her. And so he pulls up the ramp and parks, and everybody wonders, what's he going to do? He walks down the ramp, and he joins the picketers. Mm. And Mitzi, sitting there with Alan, breaks down completely crying, completely loses it. All right. And, of course, all Dave is doing is his best friend is George Miller, who was one of the strike leaders, and he would never go against George.
He's just supporting his friend.
Yeah, supporting his friend. And nobody, I didn't question anybody's motive.
Yeah.
And David was doing what he thought was right. But it destroyed Mitzi. And what that did, it made her angry. Mm-hmm. And she nixed that deal right away, and she says, I'm going to outlast him.
Wow.
And so for three more long weeks, we went through this.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, her attorney came in, and we got everybody to finally got her to sign on to the same agreement.
Mm-hmm.
And it happened, and there was peace for that day.
By the way, still the deal to this day.
Yeah, same deal.
for those of you who see the packed house at the Comedy Store going, these comics are rolling dough. Same deal. 1978, same deal, no raises, nothing like that. We're not complaining, but I'm just letting you know what the life is.
Yeah.
Well, it was a generous settlement then. And especially back when rent was, like I tell you, $200 a month, and there were no phone bills. I mean, there was nothing.
Yeah, you could pay your rent.
So it gave us what, $2,000 a month to put up our nose. You
know? Yeah.
I mean, nobody had any money at the end of the month. It was the same deal.
I love how Argus talks. You talk in like, all right, well, this is how much cocaine you could get for the salary. Like, you don't get paid it's enough for a car. It's enough to feed your family. This is how much blow you could get.
Yeah.
Well, summers were the blow.
We just there was something about us that we just hated sleep. So, but the final DC Alfina to the story is is that all of these open micers who joined the strike to show their support for the working comedians.
Yeah. Sure, sure.
Well, they thought we're waiting for our time slots now.
Mm.
And this is going, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
And if one of them included a really talented writer who Mitzi had used sort of as a filler comic in the early 70s when she didn't have that many comics during the week, named Steve Lebetkin.
Oh, yeah.
And Lebetkin called in for time slots twice and didn't get any the first two Tuesdays when he called in. And so Mitchell Walters is walking by the Hyatt house, and he sees Steve Lebetkin going in. They say hi. And next thing you know, Lebetkin jumps off the Hyatt house onto the ramp and kills himself.
Yep.
And all of a sudden, it almost restarted the strike because his friend Richard Lewis was so angry about it. They were almost in these meetings. How could Mitzi do this?
Yeah.
And it took the guy who wrote the book, I'm Dying Up Here, William Needleseeder, did some research and found all these crazy letters that Lebetkin had written his father and his family and posted them in a two-page story in the Sunday calendar section of the LA Times, which everybody read every Sunday back
then. Sure, sure.
And so everybody read the calendar section. And Needleseeder laid it out that Lebetkin was disturbed, and this thing wasn't Mitzi's fault for not giving him any time slots. He wasn't getting any time slots before the strike.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because there was always the legend that he was trying to jump and actually land like in the Comedy Store, but then couldn't make it because the jump is so far.
That's fair. But his widow slash girlfriend never said that, so I don't know who would know.
That's probably some comics just trying to start rumors.
My reaction was to have the Hyatt put a sign out saying "Beware of falling comics." You're going up that ramp. That's the last thing on your mind.
Exactly.
Whose idea was
it?
Be a
good, insurance car insurance commercial. Here comes Mayhem.
Whose idea was it to put the names on the wall? Because I feel like with every comedy club has its own prestigious elements, but nobody has what the store
has.
Getting your name. Yeah.
It was Mitzi.
Yeah.
Because still today, that is you. I mean, Brad and I can both attest.
Oh, dude.
I mean, it's literally, I worked there doing the phones for 5 years and the countless amount of, and everyone's journey is different. Some people waited for a little bit, popped in on some shows, got the right stars to align, got some cool credits, were a little further along. I mean, now we see the amount of comics that are coming through and getting past. Everyone's journey is different. So it means, but it means the same to everybody. Yeah. But I'm curious how it was when those names first went on, and what you, if you get that same feeling for people when you see it happen now.
No, it's a much bigger deal now.
Okay.
Because we were spoiled snots then. What took you so long to think of this? Right? And again, we were all two steps behind Mitzi.
Yeah.
Because she did this whole thing to help build up this new outdoor patio that she constructed that used to be a parking spot just for her and one other person.
Wow.
And she built that thing wanting it to be an outdoor place where the kids could have a drink and enjoy themselves while waiting to go into the show.
Wow. Okay? And it's still, and I mean, that's amazing.
And it's now one of the places to hang
out. It is.
That's the spot.
Even if you don't go in the show, patio.
Everybody goes by on Sunset Boulevard. You're out there having a good time.
Yeah.
Seeing the comics and, great place for dates just to hang.
It's a nightclub without being a nightclub. Yeah. You can literally just hang at that bar and you think that's see the world.
I saw something 2 weeks ago when Mike Binder got David Letterman to do the upcoming Showtime special on the comedy.
No way.
Mike Binder's got, going to have like eight specials.
Amazing.
On have you Showtime. Been, I'm sure you're all over
that. He interviewed everybody. And because Binder and I started the same year, we ran together. And there's this brand new patio on the roof. Have you seen it?
Yeah.
You've seen it?
No.
It's unbelievable. There's a plank that goes out right near to where the Comedy Store sign is.
Yeah.
And then there's a wooden, we'd say 12 foot by 12 foot patio with a couch.
On the roof?
On the roof.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
Unbelievable.
For us to hang out at.
I know. I think right now it's just for interviews, but once you see it.
Oh, that's where they've been doing
interviews. Once you're going to see it, you're going to think, maybe there's a way to get from the belly room to that roof.
Holy shit.
You could see it coming.
Yeah, there's so much space, even all the way up to Paulie's office. I never, until I worked the phones there, didn't realize how big it is.
I swear, every time I go in that building, there's a new room that makes me go, wait, what?
Yeah.
This is here?
And now you guys both killed it on my show.
We got
the Argus Hamilton's Comedy Store
tonight. Yes, plug that. Where do
Comedy Store tonight, YouTube.
Yeah.
Right? On YouTube. And I want to stress, you write a monologue for this. Like this
every week.
This is a Tonight Show caliber monologue. These are great jokes, and you have
Tonight Show caliber guests.
Yeah,
yeah, you guys for instance.
Yeah, 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 us.
No, you do. You both murder on it because you know there's a hot little crowd downstairs in the studio.
Yes, which is great.
About 15 people, great acoustics, great walls.
Yes,
we know a hot room when we see one.
Oh, in the belly, and you're doing it in the belly of the Comedy Store, which is just like, I mean, what is that like for you to be like doing that?
It only set me up for a great joke against Yakov. Because I said, we're down here. I said, Yakov, yeah, welcome to the show. You know, it's shot in the basement, just like the Romanovs were. And, he just fell over. I crippled him.
Always, you always got one. It's such a cool vibe, and I would suggest people not only watch it, subscribe to it on YouTube, but also if you're in the Los Angeles area, like you say, there's a studio audience.
Yeah, stop come on by on Tuesday night at 8 o'clock.
Tuesday night,
and,
8 o'clock.
And then download it all week. Argus Hamilton's Comedy Store tonight.
You just had Kevin Nealon on. And you guys are getting great guests. It's a fun show, and it's funny. B, if you have any questions about the inner workings of the Comedy Store.
Like, yeah, I'm your guy.
You get it there, as you can tell from this
inner
podcast.
Inner workings is a funnier line than you think.
Yeah. Wait, what? I do before we close out.
What was Mitzi like in bed, Argus?
Well, I mean, you brought it
slim
up.
Girls with big boobs, you can't beat it. Yeah. That was her power.
Oh.
She'd sit in the back of that halter top, and she was just like Oedipus with all her little boys.
Love that.
That is, there's so much, I want to know just two more things before we close out. And thank you again for doing this.
Oh, yeah.
This is, I mean, you know, I don't know if you truly know your impact on comics, and as much as, you know, you how prolific you are writing wise to still be coming in and night out and crushing and being so kind, and the conversations that I've had with you in parking lots and pre and post show, and your quick tips and advice and observing, and even though if you're, you know, in and out some nights, you're still taking in so much, and you're still, you know, living and breathing the store, and are so much you know, it makes my night when I'm there and you're there and I get to bring you up, or and I'll sit and watch. You know, it's like there's very, we all see so much. There's very few people that you, but it's truly incredible the way that you are still operating.
You guys are the kids and family I was too selfish to have. Okay. So that's a double pleasure for me.
Well, and my favorite part is just watching you do your spot and watching the faces of the people in the audience who are there to see, you know, whomever, and then just go, who's this guy coming out in the suit? You know, when all the comics are wearing t-shirt and jeans, who's this guy in a suit? And then just watching their faces just smile and laugh and go, holy shit, there ain't no school like the old school.
Yeah, thank you, buddy. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on the show. You guys are great.
Well, I do.
Yeah.
Can we do something before we wrap up?
Certainly.
You got a few more minutes? Is that cool? I want to just kind of throw out some names of people that have just come, that you have started with, that you got to see, and just get a few thoughts on each of them, and people that are you know, from the past and the present, and just a few, whether it's a few sentences or a few words or whatever.
Sure.
Roseanne Barr.
Roseanne Barr, groundbreaking comedian. And no pun intended on that either.
I mean, he doesn't stop people.
No, she came in at the perfect time of the woman's movement, needed a blue-collar spokesperson, and she just blew the roof off. Ollie Joe Prater discovered her in Colorado and phoned Mitzi about her. And then so she came in to town with Felicia Michaels and showcased for Mitzi immediately. Mitzi had Jim McCauley come in, and the next thing you know, she was on The Tonight Show. The interesting thing about Roseanne, two things, is first of all, her husband, a Colorado hippie, was the one who wrote most of that first perfect feminist act of hers. He wrote it.
Crazy.
And she delivered it, but he was the brains of the operation.
Yeah.
Okay. And I mean, he was smart and brilliant and a real feminist.
Mm-hmm.
Second thing about Roseanne I most admired is that about 10, 12 years ago, she did a HBO special in the main room in September.
I remember that.
Always
risky.
Because of the Santa Ana breezes. And the Santa Anas came in that night and knocked out the air conditioning.
Oh, fuck.
And she's got 400 people in there, and it's blistering hot. And we both know what hot rooms are for comedy.
Oh,
It's death. Death.
She's in this sheer cotton thing. She says she doesn't care. And she got up there, and she destroyed that crowd. And it was 100 degrees in that room. And that's guts like I've never seen before in my life.
Yeah, because, many other people would have canceled.
Bill Burr.
Bill Burr, had the privilege of working with him. I never saw him until I worked with him in La Jolla about 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, this is the next big one. This is the guy that has it. He's not only a brilliant thinker and a funny guy, but if you watch him closely, he uses his voice like a cornet player.
Okay.
And you're not just listening to a joke, you're listening to a song being played
the
by a cornet.
Yeah.
And that's... that has a mesmerizing effect on the crowd, just like an India flute player would have on a cobra.
Yeah, it's
that's a brilliant way to depict.
Yeah, I'd say that. I'd say like if other great examples of that would be Lewis Black, where he knows when to ramp up. He knows like he's going and he's just talking about politics, and then he's talking about the shit that pisses him off, and then
it's like
just
a timpani player.
Yeah, it just ramps up, and then. he could say almost anything, and yeah. you would laugh just because his rhythm is so perfect.
I think he watched a lot of Sam Kinison, who was a.
Oh my God! Well, yeah. Well, there's another one. Yeah, Sam.
Sam would just lullaby you with nice, sweet, funny stuff, and then the subject would turn to women, and then rage.
It would just be, oh, so you're gonna get married? You're gonna have the nice life?
Or
you're
talking about Jesus, married. Right? Yeah. You coming back, Jesus? Sure, I will. I'll be glad to. Yeah. You know, as soon as I can no longer whistle between my hands.
Just before you get married, I just want you to remember this face.
Oh, he was wonderful.
Greatest.
God.
Gerard Carmichael.
Gerard, brilliant thinker, and I wish he had hung around the store longer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I opened for him on his HBO special.
You did?
Yeah, in 2013.
Mm-hmm.
And
filmed at the store, right?
Yeah. And it was also just like Roseanne, same time of year, and the air conditioning went out. And what's worse, Spike Lee is directing it.
Yeah.
You can imagine the tension.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
But the crowd hung in there and he killed. But Gerard Carmichael had the balls, a three ball tomcat. He stood up and he stood up and talked about the good side of slavery. Okay. And he talked about how if it hadn't been for slavery, he said, me and everybody, a black person in this country would be back in Ghana right now. We owe these people.
Yeah.
And he's got the guts to do this.
Yeah.
Oh my God, if I said that.
Yeah. I always look at guys that do topics like that, and I just, Burr has a couple jokes like that where I'm going like, holy shit, like you're taking it from that perspective.
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah.
Let's see how you dig out of this hole, and they find a way.
I get out of a hole with that. I've got a great race line, and I just found a way to really pour milkshake on it.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, after I get away with it,
sure,
I say, my name is Joe Biden and I approve this message. Yeah. You know the line.
That's
I'm talking
about. Oh yeah, dude. Yeah. That is brilliant.
So awesome.
Keep going.
Dave Chappelle.
Dave Chappelle, I'm not that familiar with.
Okay.
But I admire the way he murders.
Have you, yeah. Just as far as in the, I mean, you know, because a lot of people compare, like for him, maybe being our generation's prior, more or less, you know?
Yeah, that's pretty much what everybody says.
Yeah.
I've never watched him.
Oh, really?
Never.
Wow.
You know, I don't watch comedy at home. I'm too busy working.
Yeah, you are.
You but are.
I hear he's fantastic.
Because that's a chat, him on your show is something that I feel like the powers that be could facilitate.
Well, who is it that co-wrote or co-founded?
Neil Brennan.
Oh, Neil.
Neil Brennan. Neil's is probably the smartest guy in stand-up. You know?
I would not be quick to argue that.
Yeah, I'd put him and Gerard for just these guys that are just constructing jokes where you're just like, oh my God.
Yeah. Brody Stevens.
Brody? I never saw him perform because he always went on last, but I had him on the show.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, this guy gets away with murder. Okay, he stands on the stage and he'll talk about personal improvement. And he'll talk about beat his chest like Tarzan and inspire the crowd to be great. And then pull a great punchline and then go back to his thinking. You know, and he would just hold your audience up there like the most interesting human being you ever saw in your life.
Yeah.
I thought he was more of a mesmerizer than a pure stand-up. Mm-hmm. But he got people to love him so much it didn't matter.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's a great way to describe it. He truly did. I think there's, I mean, how much do you think being likable on stage matters?
Here's a tip for you and every comic watching.
Mm-hmm.
If the crowd will love you just as much as you love it, okay? Before I go on stage every night, I'm an Episcopalian. I say, okay, Lord, please allow me to reflect your light, conduct your warmth, and radiate your joy to this audience, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Let me be the funniest man to hit this town in 43 years. Let's go. And
wow.
I walk out there. And, that, you know, your glory, not mine. And that's as sweet as I am all week. Because I'm a regular, you know, I'm a regular guy. But you know when that moment of truth is, everybody gets religion?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
Like Jeffrey Epstein before the sentencing. I'll be good from now on.
From this point on, yeah, okay. I'll be good. Right. Yeah, like, no Lord, more from now on.
Oh, yeah. Lord, give me celibacy starting tomorrow.
Two more.
Yeah.
Adam Egit.
Adam. Wow. He...
the now booker of the Comedy Store.
Yeah. The booker of the Comedy Store. He was assistant manager in 2013 when we lost our booker, Tommy, to some administrative problems.
Sure.
And
the problem being no one was going to the club.
Yeah, I mean,
Adam was thrust into this
yeah.
and didn't want it. didn't want it. I encouraged him to stick with it and stick with it and stick with it. And Adam has developed into an uncanny Mitzi impersonator. I mean, he really schedules the lineups Mitzi would in the absence of all the music, okay? In the absence of all the music. He schedules it just like Mitzi would. And he picks the comics just like Mitzi would. Mitzi didn't care on open mic night if you were funny or if you were funny. All she cared about was your charisma. Mm-hmm. Do you glow up there?
Mm-hmm.
That means you love the crowd. Do they love you?
Yeah.
And if you had that glow, she'd say, you're a regular. I'm sending you over to Westwood. You can develop that act. Okay. Adam has a different problem now because of the success of the Comedy Store. Back in my day, for a long time, you did the Comedy Store so you could get on television.
Right.
Today, you do television so you can get on the Comedy Store.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
That
makes a lot of sense.
And Adam underscored that to me the other day, or not maybe a month or two ago, when he said, I said, it's so tough for these kids to break in now. And he said, yeah. He says, to become a regular at the Comedy Store now, you almost have to not need it. And that's pretty much it. So,
yeah.
Wow. So when all the door people at the Comedy Store, our door guys, they're starting to break in and become regulars.
Yeah.
I say, no matter what you guys do, no matter what you do, you keep one shift a week.
Yeah.
You do not, because the world is full of very funny comics out there that aren't part of the Comedy Store.
Mm-hmm.
You guys don't become regulars and go out and become road warriors. You stay at the Comedy Store because your career is going to depend on this place.
It really does. It really does.
Wow. Because it's if you like riding in a Rolls Royce, you keep that one shift. Because there's a world of Chevys out there you can tool around in.
Yeah, I definitely, I stayed on the phones
career
after I got passed
for
a few more years because I knew I didn't want to, I mean, the spots were the spots, but I wanted to make sure I was around and just to soak up not only the sets, but the conversations. I don't know. I'm sure, you did a lot more of it probably when, we're starting out. But like for us, those late night parking lot conversations, the hang is so important, right?
Yeah.
I mean, is that a part of maybe some advice you would tell a young comic?
Absolutely. Stay at the store and you socialize. That's how you learn.
And stay up late, even if it's not partying in the parking lot, but you just to be around.
Be around.
And to get a chance to be in a conversation with a Rogan or a Neil or a Sebastian to where you can talk comedy or talk shop or talk life and just to get a little more comfortable in your skin and in that environment.
I would add that every bit as importantly, as you're doing that, also form a pledge class of guys at your level, okay?
Yeah.
And you all grow together because trust me, 10 years from now, you guys will get each other a lot more work than any agent will.
It's just, wow, yeah.
Yeah, and when you think about it, I mean, that's like, look at what's happening right now with sort of
Gerard
like,
putting on Tiffany Haddish on his show,
and then when that happens, Rogan and all the comics that are sort of developing from his coaching tree.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's
his tree. That's good.
Yeah.
Yeah. How do we get in that tree?
Yeah.
Is there any more space?
Yeah.
Yeah. Like
check me in.
Dean Del Rey is destroying. And,
yeah.
Crazy
and
story,
Rogan,
right?
Is it? Oh, Burr has him opening. Doesn't
yeah.
He?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
Two more? Sebastian Maniscalco.
Don't watch him enough, but
great.
I've seen him mesmerize a crowd as I'm walking out.
Yeah.
I mean, I do my set, then I go to the car because I get worked at it.
The man talks in bits.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
They say he's on one of the top grossing comedians and a guy that truly, was going back and forth from his hotel job to the store.
Yeah.
And just to, piggyback on your point about how necessary the store to not lose that.
Did he use social media to break through with all the Instagram?
I mean, I heard that a lot of bits of his were posted on like these big Italian groups on Facebook. And not that this was what catapulted it, but he did use it in some fashion. A lot of bits from whether it was specials or Montreal showcases, but video clips that got circulated on these, because that is a big part of his demo.
When I think of him, I think of a guy about on the same level in age that I did see one night. That was Theo Von.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, Theo Von is one charming guy up
right.
there. Mm-hmm. I mean, they love him.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And I said, this guy's got it.
Yeah.
Last one, and I think we all know, Mitzi Shore.
Yeah.
Who, Mitzi?
Yeah. I don't even know how you...
Mitzi is the most important person I ever met in my life. Most important. She's the Ziegfeld of our generation. And Flo Ziegfeld, was the top of the vaudeville era in the 19 teens and 20s, and had Will Rogers as his headliner, along with W.C. Fields, Eddie Cantor, Mr. Bojangles, Bill Robinson, Fanny Bryce, that was Mitzi's idol growing up. Flo Ziegfeld was the top, and his theater would be the theater that David Letterman did at 42nd Street. It was became that theater. And Mitzi was our generation's Ziegfeld. And she was an artist. She loved stand-up comic. She was a Leo to the absolute bone, okay? She was a force of nature. And up until about 1990, from about 76 to 90, she was 14 years, she was the most powerful woman in show business.
Yeah.
Without a doubt.
Because she can make or break you. Yeah.
And she purposely, I think, made a mistake similar to what I made when I turned down all the sitcoms. In 1981, she had very cleverly and smartly, because she had the Z channel in the late 70s, which was the first cable channel in Los Angeles. It just played movies, okay? She saw cable coming when HBO came on, home box office, they call it. And she had the first HBO comedy special, Chevy Chase and Friends, at the Comedy Store, okay? She got the idea. She said, I'm going to copyright the name Comedy Channel, just like it, Comedy Store, you know? She copyrighted Comedy Store, but she let them steal it in London because she knew it was free advertising for us. But anyway, she copyrighted Comedy Channel. And in 1981, sure enough, HBO comes calling. They fly her to New Orleans at the cable convention, and they offer her three specials a year, $500,000 cash, a sitcom, and name your project every single year if they can have the phrase Comedy Channel.
Wow.
And she says, no, I think in a few years I'll be developing my own sitcoms. I'm going to keep it. And they said, okay, Mitzi, are you sure? And Mitzi, I'm in New Orleans with her and Lou Deck, and doing the archives for her, and her attorney, Neil. And I said, Mitzi, this is a big deal. This is a big deal.
Yeah.
This puts us all in play. You know, network. Right. We can go around network this way. We don't have to go through, you know, the Tonight Show. We don't have to go through these stupid NBC vice presidents. Yeah. We can do our own
comedy. And then she's executive producing all of it.
She says, I don't want the store to become a video whorehouse. and HBO says, Michael Fuchs says, okay, we'll just call it Comedy Central.
Oh my God!
They say is history.
What's the best piece of advice she ever gave you?
Best,
or that you heard her give?
Best advice she gave me was when she ordered Ollie Joe Prater and Alan Steven to drive me to the Betty Ford Center, November 3rd, 1986.
Yeah, that's pretty damn good advice.
And Alan and Ollie Joe, we went in Alan's Jewish Jeep, because the only Jeep in L.A. with air conditioning. We call it his Jewish Jeep. And we get to Palm Springs. We decide to go downtown and just have one last little party in my honor at Tony Roma's. And we get smashed at Tony Roma's, ribs and shooters and everything.
Yeah.
And we get out to posh Rancho Mirage, you know, the richest suburb in America per capita. I mean, just unbelievable.
Yeah, I think state. Bob Hope used to live there.
Hope Boulevard. And it's where the Betty Ford Center is. And we go 20 miles east into Coachella Valley to Rancho Mirage in the Jeep. And I say, guys, you know, let's go to 7-Eleven and get one more six-pack before I go in. and they say, okay, it's for you. And so we drive around, and for 45 minutes, we can't find a 7-Eleven. And Alan and Ollie Joe, I can't understand why they're so agitated. They say, we just got to get rid of you, Art. We got to drop you off. So they drive up into the Betty Ford Center. And Alan and Ollie, they can't wait to get my luggage. They walk in. They walk in ahead of me.
Yeah.
The admission nurse looks at them and says, two. And then Alan Stevens says, no, wait till you see what's in the car.
Yeah.
And the way Alan tells it, he says, I get out of the car, come walking in. He says, in a suit, I look just like Jack Kennedy coming in. And they say, this is the patient? And I say, yeah, wait, you'll get to know him.
Yeah.
And so... they drove home, and there's two afterthoughts to all this. First of all, Alan and Ollie Joe had an eighth of an ounce of cocaine on them. They didn't tell me about.
smart guys.
That's why they were in a hurry to dump me off. They could get down to business. And they said, Argus is a waste. You're getting well.
You're going to be sober.
Why should we give this to you?
Yeah.
And then the final punchline is I'm performing at the Betty Ford annual reunion.
Wow.
A year later. I've got 1 year of sobriety. Mitzi's there. She's crying. And she's going to Danny Stone at the time, but he gives her the night off. She comes to Rancho Mirage to see, you know, these 800 millionaires and me, graduates of the Betty Ford
Center. Yeah.
And I'm up there performing. And I said, I talked about driving around looking for that 7-Eleven. I said, to this day, I don't know which was stupider. Mm-hmm. Me thinking that another six-pack of beer was going to fix me. Or that there was a 7-Eleven in Rancho Mirage.
Oh my God!
The great.
I owe my life to Mitzi.
Yeah,
I owe my life to her. She gave me a life. She saved it. And she gave me one back.
That's amazing.
The rest I got to give to the public because that's why she saved me.
That's amazing.
Well, yeah, man. It's you're a comedy treasure and just a fucking real life treat.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Being around you makes everybody better, man.
Absolutely.
Thanks for having me on your show. It was a lot of fun. Guys.
Was it good? Yeah.
You guys are great.
You were so fun, man.
Comedy Store tonight on YouTube. Subscribe to it.
Argus Hamilton's
Comedy Store tonight. Come to the Comedy Store. See him in the suit.
You got to have Pauly on. You got to have Pauly on soon. Yeah, that's got to be a great chat. Pauly, has he been on the show yet?
Paulie's waiting to see how the dust settles on all these documentaries before he participates.
Gotcha.
In the video.
Okay. Gotcha.
Okay.
Yeah, for sure.
We'll see it.
On social media, Argus Hamilton.
Yeah. At Argus Hamilton. At Argus Hamilton.
Perfect.
There you go.
I mean, I end every set by saying, you all remember to friend me on Instagram, okay? Yeah.
Good night, everybody.
Thanks for listening to the About Last Night podcast with Brad Williams and Adam Ray. Boy, they're a lot of fun, huh? Why don't you subscribe on iTunes to this fucking podcast? Give them a 5-star rating so this midget and this Jew can feel good about themselves for a couple minutes. Also, get on your iPhone or Android and get the podcast app. You can also listen to it on Stitcher or aboutlastnightpodcast.com, where you can hear past episodes with great guests like Lisa Kudrow, Paul Feig, Kevin Nealon, Bob Saget, Dion Cole, Chris D'Elia, Adam Devine, Michael McDonald, Jaleel White, Bud Friedman, Steve-O, Harlan Williams, Tom Arnold, Ron Funches, Rick Glassman, Blake Anderson, Anders Holm, Jessime Peluso, Joey McIntyre, and many, many more. I'm Tony Danza. Thanks for listening to the About Last Night podcast. Good night. That's it, right? You got it? Sweet. Boy, it smells good in that booth, by the way. What kind of candle is that? Hanukkah Willow? Nice.
Meh, what's up, dog? This is your pal Bugs Bunny. Say, I got a question for you. Do you know who has the head of Elmer Fudd and the body of Foghorn Leghorn? Why, that's Adam Ray and Brad Williams. Ain't I a stinker?